Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, the podcast proudly produced by the Institute on Science for Global Policy. As far as your hosts, well, you know us by now. I'm Aubrey.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Daniela.
And we're all ready to kick off today's episode on the very timely topic of water resource management in the face of climate change.
But before we do, don't forget to communicate with us during and after listening to today's episode. Hit us up on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook if you prefer, and always tag your post with hashtag ISGP Forum. Okay, where were we?
Well, I personally feel like a state of drought is basically the norm for half the world these days, don't you?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Well, to be fair, that's definitely a location-specific thing.
I was hoping one of you would mention that, because today we'll talk about water scarcity and consequent management practices in a specific region of the United States, the region comprising Arizona and the Colorado River Basin.
I think the principles of water management apply to other water-lacking locales, though.
Oh, definitely. We'll use this region as a case study today, but hopefully our listeners will be able to extrapolate to the water-requiring region nearest them.
The paper we'll discuss in this episode is titled Water Resource Management Challenges in a Time of Changing Climate, and it was written by Dr. Sharon Megdal from the University of Arizona.
Dr. Megdal's paper was debated at the 2015 conference hosted by the Institute on Science for Global Policy in collaboration with a group of concerned citizens from Tucson, Arizona. The program was very poetically called Living with Less Water.
Poetic or ominous?
Why can't it be both?
Well, regardless, the statistics that Dr. Megdal provides to kick us off are pretty staggering. For example, did you know that groundwater provides about 40% of Arizona's water supply?
I did not. Wait, isn't that kind of a problem because groundwater takes a while to replenish naturally?
That is how this works, yes. After groundwater, another 40% of Arizona's water comes from the Colorado River. This includes water diverted by the Central Arizona Project Canal, aka the CAP Canal. This canal diverts water from the Colorado River and is actually the second largest United States aqueduct system.
And then the rest of their water supply comes from recycled wastewater and a few other surface sources.
Nonetheless, various projections estimate that by the year 2060, Arizona's water supply versus demand will reach a shortage of between 1 and 3.2 million acre feet. To remind you, 1 acre foot of water is equal to just under 326,000 gallons.
Sounds like they'll be drowning in scarcity.
Please, no.
While sobering, or if you prefer, downright scary, that shortage figure doesn't even sound terribly surprising when you consider that the Colorado River Basin was celebrating its 15th straight year of drought in 2015.
That sounds like a walking advertisement. Join us in Phoenix this Saturday to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the Arizona drought. There'll be no swimming, no cold refreshments, and absolutely no excess water of any kind. Super dry fun for the whole family.
Am I the only one shocked to find out that Arizona's in a drought right now? Anyway, Lake Mead, which provides water storage for Arizona, California, and Nevada, was at its lowest water level ever at the end of 2014. Basically, there's no predictable endpoint for this drought.
And if you want to talk history, tree ring studies in the area suggest that the Colorado River's water flow over the past 14-ish years has been the lowest of any comparable time period in the past 900 and some years. So all of these stories are definitely merging.
The Colorado River supplies water to its local states and Mexico, and the river is under severe stress because of high demand coupled with decreasing water flow. And the drought's impact on the river, well, it isn't so easy for nature to fix those impacts. The debaters noted that even a whole year of quote-unquote good rainfall wouldn't fix the current situation.
And this is where water management truly comes into play, especially since we have one water source, the Colorado River, that's responsible at least partially for the water supply of many people and places. Which is why I think it's important that we return to the CAP, or Central Arizona Project. You'll see why in a minute, I think.
We already mentioned CAP in the context of the CAP Canal, and this canal is what physically supplies the water that we can allocate on pen and paper. As it turns out, there are different priorities granted to CAP water-receiving stakeholders and groups.
Major stakeholders in this conversation include Arizona's Native American tribes, which, as sovereign entities, are not bound by water management regulations imposed at the state level. Nonetheless, many of these tribes, including the Gila River Indian community, are partners in the basin's water management plans.
As it turns out, priorities for Colorado River water between states also vary. For instance, did you know that California has a higher priority than Arizona when it comes to cap water deliveries?
Considering that I didn't even know Arizona was facing a drought before, I don't know, 5 minutes ago, that wouldn't have surprised me before we started this episode. But now that I know the situation...
Same here. Isn't it weird, though, that this drought scenario is happening in Arizona, but Cleo and I, for instance, have basically never heard of it? When I think drought these days, California is definitely the first state that pops into my head. You know, because of mandatory cutbacks in water use and heavy media coverage.
You're definitely not wrong, Dee. Not many people perceive Arizona as being in a crisis mode situation right now, probably because there haven't been widespread water use restrictions in local communities there.
Mandatory cutbacks in Arizona actually aren't instated until the water level at the storage lake we mentioned before, Lake Mead, dips below the first, quote, trigger level, which happens to be 1,075 feet above sea level. The lowest level it's ever reached was 1,081 feet, just 6 feet from entering cutback mode in October 2014.
While it hasn't occurred yet, general consensus amongst the debaters was that a declaration of water shortage in Arizona is inevitable. So it'll happen at some point, especially if the region's trend of dry winters continues.
Presently, 70% of Arizona's allocation of Colorado River water gets funneled into agriculture. If a shortage becomes official, the first cutbacks would affect non-Native American agricultural users of cap water, so basically farmers who irrigate with cap water instead of groundwater.
Oh, okay, so if this happened, then the farmers would just switch to using groundwater. No biggie.
Yes, biggie. That's actually a major concern, because that's not what we want to happen.
Farmers need water, though. I feel like that's exactly what we'd want to happen.
No way. Groundwater is way cheap, so it's a no-brainer that the farmers would turn to this source of water. But what we really want is for them to adopt water conservation strategies, not swap Ghirardelli for affordable Hershey's and keep chugging away with their current levels of water usage. Instead, it'd be preferable for shortage-stricken farmers to, I don't know, change cropping patterns?
Okay, fine. I see your point. Plus, farmers switching from cap water to groundwater would probably cause groundwater supplies to tap out much faster too, which is a concern shared by both Arizonans and global drought-stricken communities alike.
But we need to remember that, as a whole, water has been managed well in Arizona up to this point. For a variety of reasons, ranging from responsible water storage facilitated by the Arizona Water Banking Authority to per capita water use falling in many municipalities, water supplies have been able to meet the needs of a growing population.
As noted during the debate, this type of water management can be informed by climate models, both global and more downscaled ones, especially those that go a step further and tie together water, energy, and food, three essential keys to life that are forever intertwined.
So in terms of water itself, obviously these models can tell us a lot about precipitation intensity and frequency. This information gives us insight into the water availability issues we've already touched on today, like the water level at Lake Mead.
And then energy comes into play when we talk about using water in any way, ranging from delivering it to other places to using it to power an air conditioner when I'm melting in my apartment.
While the food-water interface is probably a given, it's definitely worth mentioning since it's vital to, you know, all of life. In this case, foods need water to grow, so we have to prepare for impending water shortages by developing crops that can deal with being a little thirsty. Not to mention the fact that foods physically contain water, so shipping foods in a water-insecure future can essentially be thought of as shipping the water itself.
Don't forget that food prices are impacted by water, too.
You're right. The debaters noted that even though farmers would be the first individuals directly impacted by mandatory water cutbacks, city dwellers would probably feel some immediate indirect effects because food prices would likely increase.
Speaking of prices, an obvious option for kind of forcing or at least strongly suggesting water conservation would be increasing the price of water itself. This seemed to incite some debate at the conference, though.
Well, in a broad sense, making everyone pay more would probably cause people to use less water. Money can be a very powerful and persuasive tool.
The controversy, then, exists over the fact that increasing water prices perhaps most directly and significantly impacts farmers. And now we're right back where we started with the cutbacks conversation.
And with food prices increasing. And by the way, that would certainly hit the low-income populations pretty hard.
Okay, so water management implicates food, energy, and the kitchen sink, but managing water effectively will only get you so far. If that water isn't clean, well, it's not gonna do you much good, and your kitchen sink will be quite dry indeed.
No kidding. That's why Dr. Migdal claims that one of the most important roles of science in this water shortage scenario is finding ways to monitor, quantify, and treat water coming from aquifers, rivers, and other groundwater sources.
Hey Cleo, remember when we were recording our third episode of the forum and you called an aquifer a waterifer?
Hey Aubrey, remember when we were recording the 37th episode of the forum and you were the worst and told the whole world that I called an aquifer a waterifer? I was a young, naive podcaster at the time. I've grown.
Okay, allow me to just diffuse the tension here before things get out of hand. We were talking about water quality and quantification, which directly implicates water cleanliness and treatment. Treating water is definitely at the forefront of today's news. I mean, this debate was held in 2015, and here we, as a society, are 2 years later talking about drinking water contamination in places like Flint, Michigan. And in places where drinking water comes primarily from underground, well, I'd imagine that treating contaminated groundwater can be challenging. But I think the connection between water quality and quantity is a little less clear.
I think that's more of a case of, quote, if you don't have any water to clean, if you know what I'm saying. Right now, aquifers supply such a huge portion of Arizona's water that it's kind of terrifying to realize that we don't have good ways to quantify how much water is down there beneath our feet. Not to mention the fact that we can't predict how quickly that invisible water, so to speak, is replenished.
You're totally right about all of that. Only parts of Arizona's river system have been studied to determine the precipitation and runoff requirements to keep them healthy and full of good old H2O.
When it comes to water quantification, monitoring, and treatment, there's an obvious human element from the scientific perspective, too. Basically, how do all of the beneficiaries of water,
And by that she means humans.
okay, fine, how do humans interact with and use water in their daily lives? Social science has a role to play here in determining where good water practices are already in use and how these practices can be effectively transferred to other locations.
And honestly, from the looks of this paper here, it seems like the Colorado River Basin is one of those special places that we can look to for ideas about how to better manage water.
Although there are always ways to improve.
Oh, absolutely, I'm not denying that. But there are some key water management triumphs of this region provided by Dr. Migdal, which I think are worth mentioning. This regional approach rings especially true because, aside from setting standards for drinking water and discharges, water regulation is largely decentralized in the United States.
This leaves individual states to determine many of their own standards.
In general, success and innovation in the Arizona region specifically has looked like collaboration between the Colorado River Basin states, the U.S. government, Mexico, and local leaders to prepare for river water shortages, manifesting in the 2007 Shortage Sharing Guidelines and a 2014 agreement to leave water in Lake Mead.
Perhaps even more impressive has been that collaboration with Mexico, demonstrating that water availability is a global, not just regional or national issue. Working with Mexico, international surplus and shortage sharing has been established.
Yeah, I actually found it really cool to learn that in March 2014, collaboration between the River Basin states and Mexico resulted in an unprecedented release of water at the border, which caused water to flow into the Colorado River Delta. What a great example of the age-old preschool adage, sharing is caring.
Finally, we should also mention a pilot study running in the Yuma Mesa Irrigation and Drainage District in collaboration with the Groundwater Replenishment District of CAP. This study has aimed to fallow land, basically setting land aside and not growing on it for some time, and consequently save water in Lake Mead. A lot of effort is being made to accomplish water storage for long-term drought planning.
But like I mentioned before, Improvement is always possible when it comes to doling out a limited resource to a growing number of consumers, and the debaters felt that Arizona should be doing more strategizing for a worst-case scenario. Plus, I mean, with all of our food security episodes on the forum, we mention the 9 billion figure for future population size every other week. And once again, we see its relevance. More people means more water, and water is finite.
So that means the most important thing is to close the supply and demand gap. An intuitive way of achieving this goal would be to increase water conservation programs and those water prices we mentioned that encourage people to use less water in general.
I've never understood people who leave the water running while brushing their teeth.
Well, aside from using less water in general, another logical solution is increasing the number of water sources that we can actually tap into. Dr. Megdal suggests expanding the use of, or at least starting to use, 1. Treated wastewater, 2. Harvested rainwater, and 3. Desalinated seawater.
Oh, seawater! I had almost forgotten about literally the biggest water supply on Earth.
Yep, but its salt content makes it pretty useless to us when we're looking for potable water, at least for now.
Right, but maybe not in the future. In the process of desalination, seawater and even brackish, aka salty, groundwater can be treated to remove salt content. Scientific strides have been made in developing desalination technologies, but we're still hindered in a practical sense by factors like energy intensiveness and finding ways to dispose of the salt afterwards. Although, I could probably help them out with that second problem.
Oh my god, ew.
We know about your salt obsession, Aubrey, but that much salt would be overkill. Even for you.
Oh, geez, I'm just kidding.
Well, anyway, getting back to the point of finding alternative water sources, it seems that each of these alternates has its strengths. For instance, treating wastewater could be a truly local solution, and local control often requires less hoops to jump through than coordinating a project across multiple jurisdictions or even levels of government.
Next, rainwater harvesting could be pretty versatile because you could potentially match the existing water quality with its intended use and eliminate extensive purification steps. In other words, harvested rainwater could potentially be used without treatment for crop irrigation, for instance.
Finally, we come back to water desalination, which opens up the possibility in the future for new water markets or sharing options, like Dr. Megdal's example of importation of desalinated water from Mexico. Immediately, though, we see how this would require a more complex framework and not just a local government approach.
We should recognize, though, that all of these water options we've curated so far involve water needs for humans. But humans aren't the only beneficiaries of water.
There she goes with that weird lingo again.
No. See, this is the reason I used that term in the first place. People aren't the only ones with the demand for water. Come on now, Cleo. I expected you, of all people, to jump on this. The environment also has water needs, and Arizona's current water studies and policies don't consider watersheds and riparian areas that depend on groundwater.
Ugh, now you're making me feel like a bad person. No, I'm sorry, like a bad beneficiary of water. You're totally right, Daniela. And allow me to redeem myself by providing some definitions for today's listeners. A watershed is an area saturated by ground or surface water, and a riparian zone is an ecosystem of vegetation living alongside a body of water.
And it's worth mentioning that today's laws in Arizona don't really protect the environment or ecosystem, or even recognize them as things that might need protection in the face of drought.
Political support for a more thorough examination of the environmental impacts of drought is definitely lacking, possibly because these impacts wouldn't necessarily be economic in nature. And the debaters agreed that Arizona would soon be facing major environmental degradation if the environment's water needs aren't considered and addressed.
Political anything can get a little controversial. So let's swing the topic back around to where we started today. Let's finish off with a discussion of public perception of the drought scenario in the Colorado River Basin.
Apparently, in the basin region, there's a general lack of awareness amongst residents regarding the dire water situation of their area. While a handful of educational projects are underway, it's still pretty difficult to get people engaged in a topic that they don't feel is pressing.
The debaters mentioned that Tucson-based water-related meetings are typically only attended by a few dozen people, and the common comments include, "Water's too cheap, my bills are too high," and oh, my personal favorite, "You asked me to conserve water, and then you raised my rates."
Oh my God, as someone who's pretty familiar with local government, that is literally exactly what I'd expect to hear.
In general, the variability and uncertainties associated with drought make it really hard to get the public's attention, especially when you consider short-term climate oscillations, which convince people that there's no true drought occurring. It's no surprise that policymakers have a hard time increasing water rates or approving water-saving infrastructure.
Or, fixing infrastructure that's leaking and aged, which is apparently a problem in the Tucson area.
Right.
Not that there's a ton of bipartisan support for these projects anyway.
True, and that was noted at the debate, but let's refrain from opening that can of worms here, shall we?
In that case, is it time to wrap things up today?
Sounds good to me.
So, in today's episode, we've endeavored to clarify that there is, in fact, a persistent drought afoot in Arizona, and that, in general, the Colorado River Basin is making noticeable efforts to prepare for an even more water-insecure future.
But in the spirit of always improving, we've also mentioned some options for water conservation, water sharing, and alternative sources.
Give us a shout on social media and tell us what water-saving strategies you think would be most successful in the immediate future, as well as in the long term.
As always, you'll find us on Twitter at ISGP Forum, and don't forget to use the hashtag ISGP Forum. We're trying to make waves on social media here, people.
And you'll find us on Facebook as well, of course.
Thanks for socializing the science today. Be sure to tune in for our next episode, and we'll see you soon, right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.